Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the latest sentiments by the IMF, that is the International Monetary Fund, on the fact that South Africa has impressed the global community with our inflation targeting as well as our ability to get off of the dreaded grey list. We're going to speak to Chief Economist at Rand Merchant Bank, Isaiah Mhlanga, around that and get his thoughts on what that means for South Africa and where we go to from here. Then we have a conversation with Chris Yellen, taking a look at the NERSA settlement with Eskom, that 54 billion rand settlement, seemingly the subject of much controversy as it could have been much higher. We're going to take a look at this and see what we make of it and what the implications could be for South Africans. Then we have a conversation with economist at Oxford Economics Africa, Leona Esterhazen, taking a look at the cocoa prices that have recently come down, or that have been coming down gradually over the 2025 year, and what that means for cocoa products. Then we're going to wrap up the show, as we always do on a Thursday, with a small business. We're going to speak to the founder and CEO of a company called Navu Mobility, get a sense of what it is that they are doing and how they're getting it done.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick things off, as we always do, with a sense of market movements throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by wealth manager at PSG Old Oak, Skalk Lowe, to take a look at market movements and see what we make of them. Skalk, lovely to have you on the show. It only took you 3 years to get the Rand to 16 Rand 84.
I was wondering. And for the listeners out there that's listening to our conversation for the first time in this 3 years, you just to note, I mean, Jimmy's been tough on me. I mean, really, really tough on me. We will see the Rand weaken, and I will get the full brunt, but not today.
Not today.
Not today.
Now, 1684 is something else. I mean, yesterday's interest rate decision out of the US obviously having a lot to do with that. But the Rand has been fighting this year. And some of those factors include things like getting off the grey list and revising our inflation targeting. This is the best the Rand has performed since 2022.
Yeah, we need to celebrate this, Jimmy, because we were joking about the 3 year, but man, we've been tough on ourselves. We're typical South Africans. We've got high standards and we are tough on ourselves. But I mean, we need to celebrate this. And, you know, we've had the SACI business conference, conference that came out best level since 2011. Now, I know a lot of people will note that the economy within that, index is still struggling. We've had a great tourism for that month, and we know why as well. But we've had, you know, Southern Sun that came out and said that they had the best vacancies level since the Soccer World Cup 2020. We've had City Lodge also saying the similar thing. So we had a very, very good November. But how do you eat an elephant?
One bite at a time.
There we go. And we're taking those bites. I just want to mention the one thing for the listeners, because people tend to look at this, let's call it 1680, 1690 levels, and say, wow, the Rand is now way, way overvalued. I mean, this is as good as it gets. Now I'm gonna give you a economy 101 lesson. Now, it's called purchasing power parity. And I know a lot of people know it, and how I use it, I look at where we became a democracy, which is pretty much May 1994. And I've used the levels there on the Rand, and I use the Rand and the dollar levels up to now. And what you do, and this is how the Rand effectively should be weakening or strengthening, is you take the two countries, in this case the US and South Africa, you take the inflation levels and you subtract them from each other. And where the inflation levels is higher, that is how South Africa should be weakening over time. Now, if you take that pure inflation differentials since May 1994 up to now, you get a fair value, a purchasing power fair value on the Rand of just over 10 Rand to the dollar. Now people will say, now you're crazy. This is not just crazy talk. You've had too much eggnog. I mean, this is way too early, you know, to have this type of eggnog. The bottom line is, if you look at over the, let's call it the past less than 20 years, we've had a few times where we've actually broken, you know, through and even lower than purchasing power parity. So I took it one step further and I said, let's take since 1994, let's look at the average premium South Africa has traded above its purchasing power parity. Hmm. If you take that average for this, let's call it 31-year period, you still get a let's call it a fair value on the rand of just over 14 rand to the dollar. So yes, I think this might be looking at the glass way more than half full. But I'm just saying, never look at the rand and say it can't improve any further, because Economy 101 is telling us it can.
Skalk, part of that is down to obviously some of the factors that we have seen work in South Africa's favor. Part of it is the sentiments coming out of the White House and the stance that the President of the United States has taken. But if we just look at the rest of South Africa's story and we look at the rest of the markets, today was a good day from a markets perspective. We had our all share almost up a full percent, the top 40 up more than a percent. We are at record levels where we've crossed above that 100,000 points mark in both cases for the first time ever this year. It has really been a good year.
It's been a great year. Come on. What do I have to do? We're sitting with a year-to-date of over 37%. And I've got Jimmy telling me it's been a good year. It's been a great year. So let's just kick that off. And mostly, you know, if we look at the top nine performers, because the 10th performer and the 11th performer is both telecoms, Blue Telecom and MTN. But if you look at the top nine, you know, all nine of them are shiny. It is the shiny stuff. It's either the yellow shiny stuff or the white shiny stuff, gold and PGMs. So in just for interest's sake, Jimmy, if you take the top nine performers on the JSE for this year, you took the average year to date, you get an average of 200% for them. So golds and PGMs have pretty much doubled up on average, and it did help. I mean, you mentioned today the JSE did a 1% again. The resource index did 2%. We've also seen it in our month-to-month data that was released today, the mining report, showing us that we are doing really well, not just in terms of the prices we get for some of these commodities, but also on the production. Because when you look at the mining production, and iron ore compared to last year this time around, we've actually been able to produce 25% more iron ore. But here's the most important part for me, because iron ore's prices didn't really shoot up. PGMs, which we know has pretty much doubled up this year, the PGM prices, we've actually managed to grow our production for PGMs now compared to last year this time around by close to 4%. Now, this is what we want to see. We want to see us, you know, when these commodity prices are really running, we want to see us producing more of these commodities. And that's going to be ultimately be very, very good for our current account. That'll be good for our economy. And ultimately, will show the rand improve even further. So, yeah, I'm very skeptical calling stops on you know, South Africa. I think we've definitely got the wind behind us for now. And I'm carefully optimistic for 2026 for another good year. I mean, I know you're going to talk to about the IMF a bit later. I'm going to listen to that with interest, because I do think the surprise for some of these economists are going to be on the upside for South Africa, not on the downside.
South Africa hasn't had a good year. It has had a great year, and we should be celebrating that, even if we have high expectations of ourselves. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to wealth manager at PSG, Old Oak Skalklo, for joining us. Take a look at the performances of markets and the potential sentiment that might still be in the market for South Africa.
What's the secret to turning on success? Easy. The right partnership. With Telkom Business, get solutions that elevate your business. A reliable internet connection that keeps your team on track? Get fiber. An integrated, unified communications tool? Get cloud PABX. Connectivity that keeps up with the festive rush? Get unlimited LTE.
This summer, your business deserves the best. Visit telkom.co.za/business for deals that grow your business. T's and C's apply. Telkom Business. Possible begins here.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe It's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The International Monetary Fund has noted that they are impressed with South Africa's current situation in some respects. They noted that the low inflation targeting, as well as our removal from the Financial Action Task Force's grey list, are two notable events that bode well for the South African story. There are still concerns out there around some other factors, but we're going to get into this in a bit more detail with the chief economist at Rand Merchant Bank, Isaiah Mhlanga, joins me on the line now to see what we make of it. Isaiah, always lovely catching up with you. Thanks so much for taking the time. Between low growth, a grey list, reciprocal tariffs, an inflation adjustment, one can't help but wonder whether or not South Africa is on the struggles package, so to speak. It seems as though South Africa has for many, many years been the tried version of, or the hard version of economics. Take me through just how important this shift and the sentiment shift starts to become for our country.
It's very important from several perspectives. The upgrade in the credit rating that we got from S&P, still with a positive outlook, which suggests the next rating might or is likely to be another rating upgrade over the next 12 to 18 months, is a big positive. The first upgrade in nearly two decades. That tells you that the economy has turned a corner. It's on a positive trajectory. Yes, in terms of economic growth, we still have low growth, 1% expectations this year, but there is an improvement that is envisaged next year. What is the implication of this? We have seen bond yields, which is essentially the interest cost that the state pays for borrowing money, declined by about 230 basis points since May, which says the cost of debt for the state declines, and that also filters through into the cost of debt for banks, the cost of debt for individuals, the cost of debt for corporates. So the whole cost of debt for the economy reduces significantly, and that's on the back of better fiscal management. It is on the back of, you know, economic reforms that we have seen in energy. Nobody talks about load shedding these days. We might talk about load reductions to an extent, but no one worries or thinks about load shedding when they go about their day-to-day decision making. Some improvement on logistics, still early stages, but we have seen major strides from a, you know, legislative environment that sets the space for actual, you know, investments by the private sector into the logistics space. And then the grey listing matter that you raise, on average, countries take about 3 years to get out of the grey listing, you know, which is exactly what we have taken, just under 3 years. It can take up to 5 years or never for some economies, which means we have addressed the 22 deficiencies quickly enough, aggressively enough, to get ourselves from that dirty list of countries that have deficiencies in dealing with money laundering, financial crimes, which means our country can be trusted again by investors without having to put question marks before they put capital into the economy. So it is a huge, huge, huge success in terms of turning around from a policy perspective, but we still lack fixed investment into the country, which means we still need to see business confidence rise. There's still more that needs to be done from a policy perspective to lift that business confidence that can ultimately lift economic growth and job creation.
Isaiah, let's take a look at the economy and kind of where we stand at the moment. You touched on the fact that we're not out of the woods yet, and this is a sentiment echoed by the IMF. And when we look at the geopolitical tensions that we've seen globally, when we look at the word resilient, I'm tired of hearing the South African economy being referred to as resilient. It really does sound like we got the toughest soldiers package that we could have found, and we've been running with that for the longest time. But let's take a look at perhaps the state of some of the key things that we can get done, because from a recommendation perspective, the IMF has also put out a list of recommendations that could potentially be easy wins for us to implement if we are to start seeing more credible favor in capital markets, in global markets, and if we are to be an even more attractive destination. Can we look at just how we start to reposition South Africa, given that we have an opportunity to do that?
It's not really rocket science. We don't need the IMF to tell us what we should do. But yes, it's great if they can validate those points on what we need to do. It's the basics. Get the infrastructure working. Get logistics right. Our port efficiency. It's important for our mining sector, for our agricultural sector, the bulk goods movers and exporters. It's very important. Our rail infrastructure is important for the automotive sector. It's important for the mining sector. So let's get that sorted. Our water infrastructure. Any company that operates a manufacturing plant or a mining company that is mining gold, platinum, they need huge amount of water. And if our water infrastructure is not functioning, it means those companies are constrained, and therefore they cannot grow, they cannot increase capacity of production, they cannot hire more people. So let's get the water issues sorted. It's issues of crime and corruption. When tourists look for destinations to go and visit, they tend to look at whether the country is safe for tourists or even for the locals, and they go to countries which are safer. We just need to sort our crime and corruption a little bit longer. And once we do all of those, which seems to be quite obvious, really, because everybody can think about how these things help the economy grow, how they can attract, investment. Let's just sort the basics. Once we do the basics, we will see confidence rise.
Isaiah, the IMF still noted that some risks remain from the South African story perspective, and risks tilted to the downside. Are these risks enough to deter investment on a larger scale, or is it at the point where if we address some of these risks, we could very quickly turn the story into an even more positive story?
The risks are large, but it always depends on whether those risks materialize or not. If you look at some of them, the risk that we don't sort our logistics quicker enough and at a level that is sufficient to reduce the cost of doing business, the risk that we don't sort our water infrastructure, the risk that we have civil unrest because of high levels of unemployment. So the more we delay, in terms of seeing economic growth and job creation, the higher the likelihood of a social and civil unrest. But thank God we have social grants. That's the insurance we pay to make sure that we don't reach there quickly enough. But it's not sustainable. So those risks will always be there as long as we are not solving these network infrastructure issues quickly enough.
If we solve our problems and we solve them with haste, we can avoid certain risks materializing and we can finally get our country back to achieving its full potential. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the chief economist at Rand Merchant Bank, Isaiah Mhlanga, for joining us to take a look at the latest sentiments by the IMF that South Africa is on the right trajectory.
On the farm, every season brings challenges. Will the rain come? Will the soil deliver enough? But I'm not facing those challenges alone. With Omnia by my side, I receive more than fertilizer. I have access to science, innovative solutions, and people who care about my success.
At Omnia, your best harvest is our greatest achievement. Together we grow more than crops, we grow futures. Contact Omnia today and start growing your future.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, we know that there was a settlement between Nersa and the team at Eskom around the incorrect billings or calculations there of revenue over the several years. That settlement to the tune of 54 billion rand in line with what was ruled there could have been potentially a lot worse than what it was, at least according to the latest court statements or court applications. The High Court in Pretoria on Wednesday heard Eskom's application to potentially review how the regulator had determined its revenues over the next two financial years, including this year as well. And that is potentially the subject of what could be a worse of situation for Nersa. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Managing Director at EE Business Intelligence, Chris Yelland. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Chris, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time, as always. The worrying statement, I suppose, here is that the 54 billion rand was a hurried settlement to avoid further scrutiny that could have potentially exposed Nersa. What do you make of that?
Yeah, look, firstly, I just want to say that a settlement has not been reached yet. A draft settlement has been reached between the two parties, but that still has to be made an order of the court, which will then make it a settlement agreement. But before it could be made a settlement of the, the court could make an order and make it a settlement, it has been challenged by AfriForum, and the draft settlement agreement has been challenged by AfriForum and the Minerals Council of South Africa, who argue that any such agreement, was entered into irregularly. Any such draft agreement was entered into irregularly without any public participation. And the public are important, and not only the public, but industry, are important affected parties, and they should have been brought into this engagement in respect of any such settlement. So right now, this is what this latest court hearing has been about. It's about the challenge by AfriForum and the Minerals Council, against the draft agreement that has been made, and arguing that the judge should not make this an order of the court. So we're kind of now waiting for the judgment.
So, Chris, what does that then mean for South Africans? Because from the draft settlement and from the implications thereof, this would then be filtered into electricity tariffs, which would be directly felt by consumers and businesses and South Africans to recover this 54 billion rand that Eskom is set to recover if this is to be made an order. For now, as it stands, nothing is on the hook from a consumer perspective, but surely there are other implications, given that the entire basis of this conversation was an incorrect calculation, an incorrect methodology, and we don't really know how much of that has been corrected, do we?
Exactly. So the point is that Nersa made a determination, and that determination came into effect starting on the 1st of April this year, and it continues for the next two subsequent years. So it's a three-year multi-year price determination, and we're in the first of the 3 years now, and the price increase went up as per the determination, which included the mistake. In other words, effectively, according to Eskom, we're paying too little at the moment. To correct the mistake will mean that in subsequent years, because they're not going to backdate the mistake and correct it from the 1st of April, they would then start correcting the mistake from the 1st of April next year and in subsequent years. So right now, the losing party right now is not the customer. The losing party right now is Eskom. They are aggrieved. That's why they brought the court action. They are aggrieved because they feel that the price increase that they got was too low because of this mistake. And they then, brought the application to court. But before the court could actually hear it, the two parties, Nersa and Eskom, got together behind closed doors, out of the public eye, and sort of agreed that there was a mistake and agreed to correct the mistake by future increases in the price of electricity starting from the 1st of April next year. And that was then challenged by AfriForum and the Minerals Council, who said that, hang on, You know, you can't reach this agreement settlement behind closed doors. You have to engage with the public, who are the people who actually pay the bill, and that any such behind doors negotiation or settlement reached between two parties, Eskom and Nersa, was irregular, and that's where we are now. So, but the loser right now is Eskom. They are grieved that they, as a result of a mistake by Nersa, you know, they're losing billions of rands over the next 3 years.
Chris, I want to get your thoughts on the statement that was made on behalf of Nersa when this was brought up in court. Nersa, in their defense, argued that they entered into a settlement with Eskom, and that settlement does not enable, so they entered into it in an effort to achieve relief for Eskom, but also to ensure that there is no ventilation of details which could expose Nersa further. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it makes it clear that they were trying to cover up their mistake out of the public eye. I guess it was it's a very embarrassing mistake for Nersa. Not only just embarrassing, it's a 54 billion rand mistake. I mean, that's a pretty big mistake. And they were that statement by Nersa seems to indicate that they were trying to do this behind closed doors, you know, so it didn't come out, you know, the details didn't come out in public. But of course, the details always come out in public in today's world. And we now know all about it. And there have been challenges. So I think it's pretty misguided to try and do things behind closed doors.
Chris, what then should be done in this context? Nersa is the official energy regulator in South Africa, so it's not as though they're going to suddenly disappear from this conversation. But if 54 billion rand mistakes can be made and potentially look to be covered up in quietened settlements, surely from a South African and a consumer perspective, that raises a lot of concerns, given, again, as you mentioned, we're the ones on the hook for the bill at the end of it.
Yeah, look, you know, mistakes happen, even as we can now see 54 billion rand mistakes happen. Nersa has sort of said, I mean, at the highest level, that they themselves are baffled at how this mistake could possibly have happened. Because, can I just say that they identified the mistake at a high level, at a board meeting. They instructed their people, Nersa, to go and fix the mistake and resubmit it. And they did resubmit it, but they didn't fix the mistake. And the board didn't check it, obviously, that it had been fixed and it went through. So it seems to me, you know, that there are problems certainly at a lower level. I mean, the board actually identified the mistake and told them to fix it. And they didn't fix it. And it was presented to the board and the board passed it. So it's not only the board it's not only the lower level people that are at fault. It's also the higher level board who finally approved it. It points to some significant deficiencies within Nersa. This is not the first time that judgments have been awarded against them or mistakes have been made. They haven't followed their own procedures and they've had judgments against them. Because not only is there this 54 billion rand so-called mistake that needs to be recovered, there's another 40 billion. It's a total of 94 billion rand, you know, that is being attempted to be recovered after the event, these mistakes are all going to be paid for by the customer. Nersa doesn't have money, have 50, you know, it's not an illegal action that Nersa is going to settle the bill. We're going to settle the bill for these mistakes through increased prices of electricity. So it does point to some serious problems within Nersa, you know, 54 plus 40, 94 billion rands in total. That's pretty serious stuff.
100 billion rands almost worth of mistakes that South African consumers are on the hook for. We've already started to feel those electricity price increases in our monthly billings. One wonders whether or not this will be resolved and what that resolution would potentially look like. We'll have to keep an eye on that and see what develops from there. But for now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Managing Director at EE Business Solutions, Chris Yelland, for joining us to take a look at the latest developments in court between Nersa, Eskom, and other parties around the 54 billion rand settlement and whether or not that could get worse.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
2024 was quite an interesting year for the cocoa market. The price of cocoa, cacao, however it is you wish to refer to it, obviously cacao being the raw beans and cocoa being the roasted cacao beans, that market saw quite an increase in the prices in 2024 on fears of supply shortages out of the Ivory Coast. This time around, as we go into the festive period, it has seen almost a 45% decrease in a price over the 2025 year. For more on this, I'm joined on the line by economist at Oxford Economics Africa, Leona Estes, and to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Leona, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly an interesting year for soft commodities in general off the back of how some of the precious metals have been running. One might be surprised to see that this is the performance of the cocoa market, but that market has obviously had quite a bit of a different story, as I alluded to in the intro.
Yeah, like you mentioned, 2024 saw a very sharp rise in prices, and that was largely supply-driven. West Africa and Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana in specific experienced very erratic weather, and that along with the spread of various crop diseases and a shortage or a more expensive fertilizer that stemmed from the Ukraine-Russia conflict prevented farmers from actually treating their crops properly. So all those factors combined in kind of a perfect storm to drive cocoa prices to the historical highs that we saw in 2024.
Leona, let's take a look at the global markets. You touched on Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana being the West African countries that experienced some challenges there, but anyone that knows this market knows that between those two countries, they account for more than 50% of global production. I think the figure is closer to 60% of global production. Take us through what that kind of concentration means for global markets if those two countries are to have any sorts of problems.
Yeah, so it's close to 60% of global production comes from only Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana. And then there are obviously other smaller producers. Even in West Africa, there's smaller producers like Nigeria and Cameroon. So in the context of Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana specifically, the markets are also very regulated, with farm gate prices set according by the local regulator. So that means also that prices, market prices, don't fluctuate as you would see on a global level. So when there are price rallies, local farmers aren't necessarily incentivized or funded to the extent that they can actually adjust their farming practices accordingly. What is also, and we might touch on this a bit later in more detail, but what also happens if the farmers tend to even hold back supplies if they feel that the discrepancy between the farm gate price that they are paid and the actual prevailing market price is too big, they tend to hold back in anticipation of a farm gate price increase for the next season. So yeah, there's a lot of, basically global prices are driven by those two countries and global, obviously, supply dynamics as well. What this does create is it creates opportunities for smaller producers like the Nigerians and the Cameroons I mentioned earlier to come in and capitalize on the favorable price environment. So if there's a shortage in the main producers, you know, it's easier for a less regulated market like Cameroon to go and exploit that by selling, even though it's a small market and it's not necessarily going to move the needle on a, you know, on a country level or on a global scale. The farmers there are incentivized to kind of invest in the cocoa industry because they are now in a better position and a less regulated position to capitalize on the favorable prices. It also creates a problem where there's obviously smuggling incentive because Ivorian farmers or Ghanaian farmers can smuggle their cocoa across borders to less regulated markets where they can then sell that at higher prices. So that's kind of what the market distortion creates in terms of the bigger producers relative to the smaller ones.
Leona, let's take a look at what this does for the rest of the value chain. We know that a lot of the processing of cocoa then takes place in Europe in countries like Germany and the Netherlands and even Switzerland in part. What does that then do for the rest of the value chain and ultimately what consumers then see as affordable products and pricing in the cocoa space?
Yeah, so obviously there's spillover. If there isn't enough cocoa to, you know, to meet demand, then that drives up prices. And that's something that, you know, if you walk into a grocery shop, you see either the price of a chocolate, you know, per gram or per 100 grams going up, or you see you're paying the same price, but the, all of a sudden the chocolate is now smaller. So, which is obviously that something we refer to as shrinkflation. So that's obviously the gist of it. Another bigger thing that's kind of evolving is these chocolate manufacturers looking to alternatives, other ingredients that provide a similar taste or is a substitute for the actual thing when cocoa becomes either too scarce or too expensive. And just in terms of the European market, which is the obviously the main buyer, and most of West Africa's cocoa is exported to Europe and you know, the EU in particular, the EU is also or has been looking to implement the EU deforestation regulation, which it encompasses a few commodities, but cocoa is one of them, and they want to prevent cocoa in this instance being imported, that's the production thereof is linked to deforestation activities. But because West Africa is such an important market, and obviously because there's a lot of track and trace investment and a lot of, you know, implementation hurdles involved in that process, they've had to postpone the implementation of the EUDR twice. So that just kind of underscores the importance of the West African cocoa farming industry when you're looking at the, you know, the global scale of, you know, where we actually, firstly, where the manufacturers of the, you know, chocolate products get their cocoa from, and then also what the product that we end up buying, you know, where that comes from, and how those prices are influenced.
Luna, let's take a look at the trading side of it. With cocoa prices down 45% since January of 2025, surely the traders that are involved in the markets side of cocoa would be interested to see whether or not prices continue to drop, whether or not this might be the area of rebound. What seems to be kind of a fair cocoa price at the moment, all of these factors considered?
So when you're looking at the farm gate prices currently in Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana, they both set at around $5,000 a ton. So that is kind of then implied as a price floor for cocoa at the moment. So what's happened now is that in the build-up, usually the main harvest season starts in October of each year, usually. So in the build-up to this year's October 2025, farmers were obviously starting to anticipate that there's going to be an increase and a correction in the farm gate price. So it's strategic in that sense to then sort of hold back some of the supplies to wait until obviously the price increases, so you can sell it at a higher price. So with that happening and with prices being hiked to around $5,000 a ton, farmers have now obviously artificially boosted supply significantly to the extent that's fueled this downturn in cocoa prices. So with that in mind, from a trading perspective, your margin gets squeezed because your selling price and the price that you have to buy cocoa at now, which is the farm gate price, are so close together. So traders' liquidity and ability to actually buy the cocoa is also decreasing. So what's happened now recently is that with the sharp increase in cocoa bean arrivals at ports in West Africa, it's resulted in congestion and backlogs of supplies at these ports, because obviously farmers are pushing more and more beans into the market, but there isn't enough liquidity in the market to actually buy this cocoa. And with prices coming down, there's even been reports of farmers now just trying to get all the beans that they can off the trees, because they are fearing that regulators will now cut or will consider, you know, cutting the farm gate price. So that kind of is just fueling the cycle. But I do feel that this, and it's already, you know, cocoa futures, US futures turned at just about $5,000 a ton, and it's now sitting at about 6,200 again. And I think that in the near term, we might see prices actually increasing a little bit, because the decrease in the price hasn't necessarily been underpinned by improving supply, improving farming conditions or farming techniques in West Africa, or greater plantations to that extent. The structural issues that resulted in the supply squeeze over 2023-2024 is still present in the market. So it's mostly short-term dynamics driving these price increases and price decreases. So I don't think that we'll see prices necessarily sitting at a fixed level in the near term. We'll probably continue seeing some short-term volatility.
Luna, let's wrap up the conversation taking a look at the other markets out there and what they could potentially bring to the table. We know Latin America, particularly countries like Ecuador, seem to be increasing their production quite a bit, and there are some estimates that say that they might rival the likes of Ghana in the near future. I want to take a look at what that does for the cocoa market, but also taking a look at the fact that this is something you mentioned earlier in the conversation, the strict laws and regulations, at least from an EU perspective around traceability, seem to be coming in even more so now than ever. And this creates that conundrum where suppliers, producers have to now ensure that they abide by the laws, but also that the market itself agrees with some of the pricing that's there. Take us through kind of just how the shift is playing itself out and perhaps how it could change the cocoa prices in the near future.
Yeah, so I think, and this is true for, you know, many agricultural goods, is once, you know, prices increase, everyone wants to plant that crop because, you know, it's looking like the most, you know, profitable thing out there. And then once supply increases and prices come back down, you know, you're kind of back to square one. So in the case of cocoa, I think there's definitely gains to be made, and the marginal gains for the smaller producers, some that you mentioned, there's, you know, others in Africa as well, in Latin America, the marginal gains to be made there, I think, is quite significant, because obviously they have kind of an informal, like, second mover's advantage. So they can look at the bigger producers and see, you know, where they can, I guess, be more strategic. And then also they have the advantage of, you know, they were to, you know, exploit or access the EU market, they can start implementing those regulations. Easier for them to do on a smaller scale and to build up than it is for a Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, who already has a massive market, to now go and kind of backwards engineer that whole track and trace process. So they, and that coupled with that, there's more, they're more responsive to actual, you know, market pricing, that the free market system works a little bit better and works faster in those smaller producing countries. Yeah, so it's difficult to see that necessarily, or, you know, projecting which countries will become the next big player, because it also takes time for crops to actually start yielding. I think it's about 5 to 7 years for, you know, a crop to actually, you know, become fully productive. So a lot can change in that timeline, I think. But I do think that it offers diversification opportunities for a lot of other, you know, countries. And in terms of a consumer perspective, it's obviously better. And the risk profile of things like this supply squeezes happening will decrease, or the risk profile thereof will improve if you've got a broader range of producers. So from a country perspective, even if you're looking at Ivory Coast specifically, they know that they are overexposed to cocoa, and they have, you know, focusing a little bit more on other commodities like gold and oil and gas. But from a consumer perspective as well, we will, you know, at the end of the day, benefit if there's a broader range of producers that limit supply volatility, and then obviously leads to more stable prices.
The interesting world of cocoa and the pricing of the cocoa market. We'll see how this shapes up and what continues to drive this market as we go into the new year. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Luna Esterhazy and the economist at Oxford Economics Africa for joining us to take a look at the cocoa market and what we make of it.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It's SME of the Week time. We are speaking to quite a special business this week. A remarkable business built by a remarkable young lady that aims to solve a lot of problems that we might not even be aware that we have in South Africa. The business is called Navu Mobility, and the company's founder and CEO is Amohetswe Shale. She joins me on the line now to see what her business is all about and how she built it. Amo, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about Navu.
So Navu is a prosthetic startup company that is focused on making artificial limbs affordable but highly functional for amputees, not just in South Africa, but around the world. This is a problem that has been documented by the World Health Organization, the Red Cross, and many other organizations, that people are not able to afford prosthetics, right? Amputees lose their limbs, and they realize that, you know, a prosthetic leg costs upwards of R1 million, and it's just unaffordable. And when they go to public hospitals, they get subpar functionality, and they just can't get back to their lives. And so we've decided to tackle the prosthetic knee first, and we've designed an affordable, functional, polycentric prosthetic knee that is suited for South African pockets and ensures that amputees can get back to their lives again. That's what we do, essentially, in a nutshell.
Amo, when you say affordable prosthetic, how did you design it? What makes yours different to what is out there in the market?
So I have a bachelor's degree in medical orthotics and prosthetics from Walter Sisulu University. So I have had a front row seat to the devastation that comes from amputation, especially lower limb amputation. In South Africa, you have public healthcare and you have private, right? And in private, once you get amputated, you have to pay close to R1 million for a prosthetic leg. This is a functional prosthetic leg. It can do everything, you know, the ones that you see on TV. But if you don't have that money, you go to public. And in public, you basically get a hinge for a prosthetic leg. And it does the job, but it's so, so painful for users. And many, many patients, you know, end up abandoning prosthetics. There's research that shows that, you know, users in African countries will actually have a higher chance of abandoning their prosthesis, because prosthetics are not designed for us, right? They're designed by a company in Europe and shipped here with the hope that it'll stick. But so what, that's the first problem, right? Like function. Secondly, then affordability, as I said, if you don't have that R1 million, you are going to get subpar prosthetics. And that is a problem that we believe should not exist. It should not be that your functionality, your independence should be determined by how much money you have in your pocket. And that's the problem we're trying to solve.
This is certainly quite a brave initiative that you have embarked on. Amo, tell me about just the journey that you've been through. I understand at the moment you're currently being supported by Stellenbosch University in this endeavor. Take us through the journey, what it's been like building this business, and where the business is today.
So the idea started during my undergraduate research. I was trying to help patients, as I said, because with the clinical experience I had, I felt like I wasn't doing anything to actually help the average patient. And so I did my research in affordable prosthetic knees during my undergrad, and we designed a prototype, an early prototype on something that could work. And we used like off-the-shelf components like bike shocks to sort of create high functionality, but at a low price. And I moved that research into my master's in biomedical engineering. And that's where we've been right now. And we've iterated. We're at our third prototype currently with this research at Stellenbosch. And right now we went through the spin-out process. And that means that, you know, we're officially a Stellenbosch company, Stellenbosch University spin-out company, meaning that we have, you know, like a lot of the support that comes with such a huge institution, legally, like IPs, you know, like accounting help. And so that has been a really, really big achievement for us. Also, we've just won Top Student Woman Preneur at the EDHE competition, and we've won fourth overall best in the APSA Innovation Challenge, meaning we have been able to get the exposure necessary to break into such a difficult industry, as you said, right? It's a really, really, really hectic industry. So we've just been great, and right now we're working towards our pilot to get this on users and to get it into the market as quickly as possible. So it's been a sprint, a year-long sprint, but we're getting there.
It also means that you and your team are remarkably intelligent individuals solving problems that many people often overlook. So Amo, take us through what's next for the business. Where do you want to see this going? I mean, obviously for you, it sounds like affordability is absolutely critical in terms of part of your development and how you're developing your solutions. But take us through just what you aim to achieve with the business and how you're able to use kind of all that you've learned in the practical sense of what you're building.
So the goal is for Navu to be a trusted prosthetics provider in both public NGOs and even private hospitals, because to be honest, like, the prices even in private are heavily marked up. So we want to be a trusted partner for, you know, healthcare providers who are providing prosthetics. And so the first step now is our pilots, as I said. We're trying to manufacture at a small scale so that we can get it to clinics, and clinics can sort of test it out and see what they like, what they don't like, and we can iterate from there. We are planning in the next 2 to 3 years to scale into other African countries like Botswana, Namibia, and so on. And so really, besides, you know, the technical stuff, right? Because I can go on and on about the product itself, but the impact is to, one, make prosthetics more accessible, right? You have a lot of amputees in South Africa and a lot of amputees in Africa, and yet no one knows about prosthetics, right? So there's a big gap there, an information gap that we want to close. And the first way to do that is to bring prosthetics to the people who actually need them. Number two, it's to, like, create an ecosystem where repairs are simple. Right now in prosthetics, there's no repairs, right? Should anything happen to your expensive, fancy prosthesis, you need to get a new one. And that's unsustainable, not only, you know, economically, but also, like, socially. People are not able to walk for a whole month until they get their next prosthesis. So we want to create an ecosystem where we can repair and keep our prosthetic devices for longer. And so we are actively working with communities like amputee communities and clinicians in order to make this a reality. Ultimately, sustainable local solutions are, you know, the future of not only this country, but our continent. And we want to be part of that, part of the revolution to making prosthetics and rehabilitation in general in the forefront of healthcare as well.
Navu Mobility, looking to be the future in prosthetics and looking to create affordable prosthetic solutions for South Africa and the African continent. Such an inspirational story. All the best to you, Amo, and your business. Thank you so much for the time and for giving us a bit more information around what it is that you're working on. That's Amo Hetswe Shale, the founder and CEO of Navu Mobility, joining us for this week's SME. Inspired by the SME of the week? Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
That's the sound of your business growing. Whether you're starting out or scaling up, turn your passion into profit with Capitec Business Banking. Save up to 50% on fees. Get fast credit approvals, personalized support, and Forex for your business. Open your business banking account on our app. Bank on better with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, 46669. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And that's the show for today, folks. That's the show for the week. If you've missed any of our conversations throughout the week, you can catch up on them as podcasts. We do, of course, make them available for you to revisit. Going into next week, it will be the final week of the year for us. We will be taking a bit of a break over the festive period as markets do start to close and wind down as well. But we will be reflecting on some of the interesting stories that we've had over the last year. We'll also be reflecting on the performances of each of the sectors that stand out over or in local markets, as well as how they've been comparing to their international peers. But that's what's coming up next week. For now, Greg Kurse is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed by the top sport team, which means from my side, until next week, good night.